From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And then he said, I don't understand why we're here. They hate us. They just hate us.
Nadja McCaffrey talking about her son, Specialist Patrick McCaffrey. He was killed in Iraq. This week, on the second anniversary of his death, his mother learned that the Army had lied to her about how her son died. Today, Nadja McCaffrey talks about a cover-up. Then, on June 28th, the state of Tennessee is scheduled to execute 5 men. 3 executions are expected to be stayed. The last execution in Tennessee was more than 40 years ago.
On June 28th, Tennesseans face a ghoulish prospect. We've only had one execution in over 16,000 days. But on next Wednesday, we face the prospect of a double execution. Both Sedley Alley and Paul Dennis Reed are facing the needle here in Tennessee.
Then Julia Wright, the daughter of the famed writer Richard Wright, is here to talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I've come from France to speak about a turning point in the struggle to liberate Mumia Abu-Jamal. A city outside Paris, Saint-Denis, has named a street in his honor.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has been secretly monitoring thousands of international bank transactions without court approval. The secret program was enacted shortly after the 9/11 attacks and what government officials say is a crucial weapon in tracking the financing of terrorist activity. The information's been obtained from the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT. The organization helps direct trillions of dollars in daily international bank transfers. Officials told the Los Angeles Times the program's been marginally successful in tracking the financial activity of al-Qaeda. SWIFT executives apparently tried to withdraw from the program after becoming concerned over its legality. The executives were persuaded to continue their cooperation only after the intervention of top government officials, including former federal chair Alan Greenspan. Major stories on the program appeared in today's editions of the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Both the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times say the Bush administration lobbied them to withhold publication on grounds public disclosure would harm national security. In Iraq, the government has declared a state of emergency following a series of attacks in Baghdad. Earlier today, insurgents set up roadblocks and opened fire on U.S. and Iraqi troops close to the U.S.-run Green Zone. Elsewhere in the Iraqi capital, 10 people were killed, 15 wounded in a bombing of a Sunni mosque. Another 19 deaths were reported around Baghdad. Meanwhile, in Basra, at least 5 people were killed and 15 wounded when a car bombing struck a market in a nearby gas station. The Times of London is reporting the Iraqi government is preparing a major amnesty offer to Iraq's resistance groups. The amnesty would promise a timetable for withdrawal of foreign troops, inclusion in the political process, a halt to U.S. operations on insurgent strongholds, and compensation to civilian victims of armed attacks. There are no signals the U.S. government has backed the proposal. A White House official said the administration has not agreed to any offer that would grant amnesty to insurgents who've killed U.S. troops. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate rejected 2 separate withdrawal measures calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. This is Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist.
None of us know for sure exactly how the democratic reform in Iraq will turn out as we stay committed. But we do know it will fail if it is abandoned prematurely by the United States. Withdrawal is not an option. Surrender is not a solution.
Both measures were proposed by Democrats. A proposal calling for withdrawal without a firm deadline was defeated 60-39. Another measure calling for troop withdrawal by July of next year was defeated by an even wider margin, 89-13. The measure was introduced by Massachusetts Senator and former Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. Speaking on the Senate floor, he argued that a firm timetable is necessary.
Why on earth would senators want to come to the floor and argue, oh, let's just stay the course and do the same old thing when our own generals have told us the same old thing is part of the problem? The same old thing is attracting terrorists. The same old thing is losing us allies. The same old thing is costing us unbelievable sums of money and costing us lives unnecessarily.
Senator John Kerry. In other congressional news, the House voted Thursday to roll back parts of the estate tax. Republicans call the bill a compromise because it doesn't completely eliminate the estate tax on those who inherit property. The House bill exempts taxes on individuals with estates valued up to $5 million and on couples with estates valued up to $10 million. Heirs of estates valued at up to $25 million would also see a drop in their tax rates. The bill will now go to the Senate. Congressional tax experts estimate that only 5,100 estates would now face taxation, down from the current number of 30,000 taxed estates. The bill is estimated to cost up to $300 billion. The House vote came just one day after the Senate rejected a measure that would have raised the minimum wage for the first time in nearly a decade. In Miami, seven people were arrested Thursday on charges of plotting to launch attacks inside the United States. The alleged targets include Chicago's Sears Tower, an FBI office in Miami, and other federal buildings, according to authorities. They say the suspects prepared for the attacks out of a Miami warehouse. The seven are believed to be young American Muslims in their late teens and early 20s. A man claiming to be a member of the group told CNN Thursday they're peaceful and innocent of the charges. At the United Nations, the Bush administration pressed on Thursday with its campaign to prevent Venezuela from securing an open seat on the UN Security Council. Under UN rules, Latin American governments are entitled to pick a country from the region to fill the rotating seat that comes open next year. Brazil, Argentina, Cuba, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay, and several Caribbean nations have already backed Venezuela. The U.S. is lobbying for Guatemala to get the seat. This is UN Ambassador John Bolton.
Our view is that Venezuela would not be a constructive member of the Security Council. We've made that clear in a number of diplomatic efforts, Jean-Marc. That's our position, which I think we've expressed quite strongly and quite clearly.
In Bolivia, the government says it's obtained proof members of ex-President Sanchez de Lozada's government stole millions of public funds. On Thursday, Bolivia released video footage apparently showing ex-government figures looting money from Bolivia's central bank. The footage is dated just days before de Lozada's government was forced from office in October 2003. In Germany, Thursday, a parliamentary inquiry heard new evidence the government failed to take action upon hearing Khaled al-Masri had been kidnapped and handed to the CIA. Al-Masri is the German citizen who was kidnapped and held in a secret prison in Afghanistan, where he says he was repeatedly beaten and drugged. He was eventually released after his captors realized they had the wrong man. This is Wolfgang Neskowitz of Germany's Left Party.
Today's examination was another piece in the puzzle that shows that the German government's claim it had only heard of al-Masri's abduction after he was freed is wrong.
In environmental news, the National Academy of Sciences has released a study showing that the recent surges in global temperatures are unprecedented for at least the last 400 years and potentially the last several millennia. Keeping in mind natural factors such as volcanic eruptions and solar radiation, the study nonetheless concludes that available evidence supports the argument that human activities are responsible for much of the recent warming. Meanwhile, a new study by the National Center for Atmospheric Research has found global warming accounted for close to half the extra warmth found in the tropical North Atlantic waters that fueled hurricanes last year. The study said natural cycles were only a minor factor, contradicting claims that natural cycles are responsible for the recent increase in Atlantic hurricane activity. Meanwhile, the UN is warning this year's hurricane season could lead to another major disaster in Haiti. More than 1,500 people were killed. Thousands of homes were destroyed when Hurricane Jeanne struck Haiti in September of 2004. This is Erta Mergan of the UN Developmental Program.
Our main problem, I will say, is not per se the preparedness and the response capacity of the country. It's the high state of vulnerability of the country. Haiti is now has such a depletion of natural resources that we don't really need a major hurricane to break havoc. We just need just normal rain can cause a lot of damage. So this is the threshold for a disaster to happen is very low in Haiti.
In privacy news, AT&T has introduced a new policy that says the company owns customers' account information and can share it with government agencies. Under the new policy, AT&T will collect customers' users' names, passwords, charges, payments, and online purchases. It'll also track their activity while on sites that AT&T operates in a partnership with Yahoo, Inc. The changes come as AT&T is embroiled in a lawsuit brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation over the company's involvement in the NSA spy program. And finally, a play based on the writings of the late peace activist Rachel Corrie has finally found a theater in New York. My Name is Rachel Corrie will open at the Minetta Lane Theater in October. Based on Rachel's diaries, emails, and letters, the play was originally supposed to show at the New York Theater Workshop in March, just days after the three-year anniversary of Rachel Corrie's death under an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza. But the workshop's directors indefinitely postponed the production following concerns over its political content. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, to see our exclusive interview with New York Theater Workshop director James Nicola, who had rejected the play, and with Rachel Corrie's parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military is being accused of another deliberate cover-up involving killings in Iraq. But this time, the victims are not Iraqis. They're American soldiers. Specialist Patrick McCaffrey and First Lieutenant Andre Tyson, both members of the California National Guard, were killed in June 2004 while on patrol near the town of Balad, 50 miles north of Baghdad. Military officials initially told the families that the two soldiers had been attacked and killed in an ambush by insurgents. But the story turns out to be a lie. An Army investigation concluded in September of 2005 that the two men were in fact killed by members of the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, supposed allies that the guardsmen had been training and patrolling with. McCaffrey and Tyson's fellow soldiers had suspected this was the case all along. Instead of sharing these findings with the families, the military sat on the story for 9 months. It was only after Nadja McCaffrey, the mother of Specialist Patrick McCaffrey, asked California Senator Barbara Boxer in May to pressure the Pentagon to release information about her son's death that the truth has come out. The military revealed what it knew only this week, 2 years after the killings of McCaffrey and Tyson. An Army general briefed the families at their homes on Wednesday. The Pentagon is now being accused of a deliberate cover-up. Senator Boxer said the case raises troubling questions and plans to raise the issue on the floor of the Senate. She told reporters, quote, "I think it's pretty obvious that if the American people knew that the Iraqis we train would turn on our soldiers, support for the war would erode." This is not the first case of its kind. Also in 2004, NFL star Pat Tillman was killed while serving in Afghanistan. The Army initially said Tillman was killed by enemy fire while leading troops into battle. The high-profile story was widely reported in the media. But the Army was later forced to acknowledge that Tillman had in fact been killed by gunfire from his fellow soldiers. We go now to Tracy, California, to speak with Nadja McCaffrey, the mother of Specialist Patrick McCaffrey. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nadja.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. And again, our condolences on the loss of your son, Patrick. Can you tell us what you learned this week?
Well, that was a bumpy week. This week I learned, and I had the visit of a general and three high-rank officers at my house. And this was to let me know that the report that I had received originally in 2004, after my son's death, was not true. Was not exactly a report. Nobody bothered to give me a report, but what we know was exactly that Patrick and Andre were attacked and in ambush, and they were both killed. We since then asked many, many times a report on Patrick's autopsy and a report on the result of the ambush or the investigation from the ambush. And then we were answered absolutely nothing. Letters, email, you name it, phone calls. I don't know how many times I personally called the Pentagon, nothing. we would be given another phone number to call to, or another direction within the country to call to, like military here, another some other person in Washington, D.C. It didn't make sense. So I really was fed up with it. And I just walk up to Senator Boxer and I just ask her, please, can you help me with this? And then, boy, 2 or 3 days later, I started to get a phone call from the Pentagon telling me that a doctor would call me in the next few days to give me a report on Patrick's death from the autopsy. It happened just like that. So the doctor that called actually worked on Patrick and remember Patrick very well when he came in from Dover. And she also sent me the next day by FedEx CD with pictures and the arrival first of Patrick out of the body bag and the whole procedure of the autopsy.
The San Francisco Chronicle piece on your learning this week on the second anniversary of Patrick's death, what actually happened to him, begins, "Fellow soldiers knew within minutes on June 22, 2004, that California National Guard Specialist Patrick McCaffrey and First Lieutenant Andre D. Tyson had been killed by supposedly allied Iraqi soldiers who were patrolling alongside them. Army investigators reached the same conclusion in 2005. So his fellow soldiers knew immediately. Have you talked to any of his buddies who survived and came home?
Oh, yes, I did, and I actually run my own investigation, and I have accumulated a box, actually a couple, 2 or 3 boxes of papers. People send me email from cross-country, people who were in Iraq, people who just were home, but also check from one soldier to the other, accumulated that. And somebody in Los Angeles, a professor Wolf, really made a lot of time for this investigation. He followed it from the beginning, and he really helped me, you know. And obviously something was wrong from the start. We needed to pinpoint what it was and how it was presented to us. It was totally wrong, you know. It was just false. It didn't work. I mean, it didn't make sense. Many things did not make sense at all.
But no member of his unit came to you and said, it's not as the Army has told you, I was there.
Yes. Yes, 2 or 3 people did.
And did they tell you this?
They told me, yes, what they saw and what they have heard. As a matter of fact, just after Patrick and Andre were killed, one of the soldiers made his own report, and very complete, I may say. And this report was actually sent to the Sacramento Bee in Sacramento newspaper. And this article was actually published by the Sacramento Bee. Immediately after that, this article was all over the world because when Patrick's body returned to the airport in San Francisco, I called the media, and that made a huge fire within the news and so on, since the Pentagon had a ban on that.
Well, let's explain the idea that you called the national press to be at Sacramento Airport, International Airport, when Patrick's body came home because President Bush had issued this executive order saying that you shouldn't videotape, photograph, film the flag-draped coffins of the soldiers coming home. But you defied that.
Yes, yes, I didn't want it to. That was my son. Frankly, I didn't really care, you know. I needed to do it this way for us, and I wanted to honor my son. I was not going to pass him in the dark returning home, no. He didn't left in the dark. Why should I do that when he comes back? No. But because of that, immediately after this article took off and was everywhere. What happened was the soldier who wrote this article was threatened to be court-martialed immediately. And the only reason that the court-martial didn't happen, it's because it became too public too fast. But he, nonetheless, was in serious trouble. I knew that through his mother, and she was extremely worried about it. So I talked to other soldiers in his unit, And I called, you know, GI at Long, and different people that I know I needed advice from, just in case something would turn ugly. He's okay, but it was not easy for him for quite a long time.
What was his name?
He's still Ian, so I'm not sure if I should. So his first name is Chris.
But, and his report was published and he was named in the papers.
Yeah. Well, yeah. His name was Chris Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he's a very nice young man. He didn't think. He was 19 or 20 years old. You know, he reacted. He loved Patrick. Patrick was his friend, like a dad figure, you know, and he protected him. When he got in trouble, Patrick would defend him, and which he did with all the young soldier, you know.
Well, wasn't that why Patrick decided to go to Iraq? I mean, why did he join the military? And then why did he decide to go to Iraq? They were two different decisions.
Well, he did not want to go to Iraq at all. He enlisted after 9/11 to become a National Guard. And he wanted to do this because he reacted from, of course, the catastrophe of the tower in the 9/11. And he didn't end his stay immediately. He thought about it, and he wanted to do something for his country. He wanted to help. He would have been here for Katrina. He would have, you know, and he, there was a fire between Shasta and Reading that burned for 10 days, if I remember correctly, last year. Nobody was there to stop the fire. It burned over 15,000 acres of woods and land, houses, you name it. People just left their home and let it burn. Now, Patrick would have been part of the National Guard to be there to stop the fire. And once he was in Iraq, well, he was deployed anyway, of course. So once he was in Iraq, he took him a very short time to realize, you know, that this was not at all what we said we were doing. And he said to me many times, not just one, but it didn't take long for him to admit and say, Mom, we shouldn't be here. We have nothing to do here. We are not fulfilling any of our promises to the people. And he lost his illusion. And because of that, after that, he turned to the children, the Iraqi children, and the soldier.
Now, the Army is saying that it was the Iraqi troops he was training that turned their guns on him and Andre. You got a video of the troops he was training?
Yes.
How did you get this?
This, I didn't know I had it. And because we got Patrick's laptop just a little time after he was killed and returned home, I left that laptop the way it was for a long time, just looking at the pictures that came up. And then this year, for his birthday, actually, on May 26th, I decided to maybe to burn some DVDs because there was so much material on the laptop, and I was thinking, you know, if something happened to it, we're going to lose it. So I decided to burn some DVDs. And somehow the whole process got stopped, so I tried to play with it a little bit and started to work, and then it did download into a DVD. And it was something I'd never seen before. It was, there was pre-video training of Patrick training the Iraqis, shooting and doing some exercise. We see Patrick very clearly on the three. And I remember afterward that he told us, his wife and I, that he was going to send some DVDs home. We never get the DVDs. Well, I think this is the answer. He didn't have time to do it.
Now, do you know who of these men killed your son, Patrick?
No, I don't know exactly which one precisely. But I'm sure the men who killed him are in those three videos. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I want to tell our listeners that you can go to our website at democracynow.org. For our viewers, we have been running the videotape that you got off of Patrick's computer. We've been running it through this broadcast. Again, our website is democracynow.org. Has anyone been taken into custody for the killing of Patrick and Andre?
I'm not too sure. I was told by the general and the officer yesterday that there was one person in custody, but there is no name on it. I don't know yet. I really would like to know. Because last year, I remember when the 579 came home, there was a gathering here at the house, and many of them were present. They say at the time that the sniper that shot at Patrick and came just at the last minute of the shooting from behind the wall. Well, you know that sniper has disappeared from the military investigation. And this man was supposed to be arrested last year. Now, they also said that the man that they have arrested was part of the shooting, but they also said there was a second man, and they think that second man is dead. I'm not sure. It doesn't make sense. Again, it doesn't fit with what I have heard last year and with what I'm hearing from them now. Also, I confronted them with some details that really are not possible. The way he did, the officer described the scene of the shooting is impossible. Why? Because the direction of Patrick's bullet wound. It's not right. It's just something is very wrong. So I'm not sure. I'm going to look into it. But and I want to do the second, because the first investigation that was started has been closed. And now they are reopening a second investigation, which is a criminal investigation. And it's not going to be the same people running it.
Is Senator Boxer going to be calling for a hearing in the Senate?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes, she has been wonderful.
Well, Nadja McCaffrey, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Nadja McCaffrey's son, Patrick McCaffrey, killed in Iraq June 22, 2004. She learned on the second anniversary of his death that the Army had lied to her originally about how her son died. We will continue to follow this story. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him...
Buffy St. Marie singing Universal Soldier here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The state of Tennessee has announced 5 death row prisoners are scheduled to be executed this Wednesday, June 28th. The announcements come as a shock to some in the state, which has carried out only one execution since 1960. Scheduled to die are Sedley Alley, Paul Dennis Reed, Charles Rice, David Ivey, and William Glenn Rogers. Legal experts are predicting 3 of the men, Rice, Ivey, and Rogers, will not be executed Wednesday because they still have state and federal appeals available to them. However, that's not true for Sedley Alley or Paul Dennis Reed. Last week, however, the Innocence Project filed a brief on behalf of Sedley Ali. The New York-based legal group argued he should not be executed until he's given access to post-conviction DNA evidence that could prove his innocence. Ali was originally scheduled to be executed last month, but Tennessee's governor granted him a 15-day reprieve just 8 hours before he was scheduled to die. Well, Randy Tatel is joining us now from Nashville, Tennessee, executive director of the Tennessee Coalition Against State Killing. Welcome to Democracy Now, Randy.
Good morning, Amy, and greetings from Music City, USA.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about these cases? First of all, first it was five?
Right. The last three gentlemen that you mentioned have what we refer to as automatic dates that we never consider to be real dates. When a inmate transfers from one level of appeals to the next, and in this case for them it was from direct appeals to state post-conviction, the state automatically sets an execution date, and once the papers are filed from the inmate's lawyers requesting to continue with the appeals, and those dates disappear. And in these three cases, those are simply either computer-generated or automatically generated dates. And we never considered those to be real dates. However, as you mentioned up front, that the dates for Sedley Ali and Paul Dennis Reed on next Wednesday are considered very real.
Can you talk about the case that the Innocence Project has taken on?
The Innocence Project came in on Sedley Ali's case. And as you mentioned again, the state has physical evidence that has never been DNA tested, and Ali's federal attorneys are saying that the testing of this evidence could actually prove his innocence, and that's what they're claiming. And of course, Barry Scheck and the Innocence Project came in on this. The state has taken what we think is an awkward position to hold, in that why would you want to withhold evidence that could reveal the truth? Isn't that what justice is supposed to be about? If there is evidence, and we know the power that DNA evidence testing has to either convict or to exonerate someone, why don't the state officials want to have certainty in this case? It's a question that many of us are asking right now.
Can you talk a little more about Tennessee and the attitude of Tennesseans to the death penalty?
Well, sure. Tennessee has had only one execution since 1960, and that was in April of 2000. And as it turns out, Robert Glencoe, who was executed then by lethal injection, was a severely mentally ill individual who was taking over 20 medications at the time of his execution to manage his multiple diagnosed mental illnesses. So that's one execution in over 16,000 days here in Tennessee. And now suddenly we're faced with having two executions on the same night. But Tennessee is an anomaly here in the former Confederate states, insofar as it has had so few executions during that time period. I believe more than 85% of the executions that have taken place since the reinstatement of the death penalty have taken place here in the former Confederate states, yet we've only had the one execution. And so we're often asked, why do we think that's the case? And there are a couple of reasons, I think, for that. One is that up until the current attorney general, whose name is Paul Summers, none of Tennessee's attorney generals since reinstatement of the death penalty have held a capital punishment as a valuable political tool and supported the use of capital punishment for political or other purposes. It was never a priority of their agendas during their general attorneyships. However, that's changed under Paul Summers, who's a very strong advocate of the death penalty and has sought, I believe, more than 20 execution dates since Robert Coe was executed in 2000, and all of them have been stayed to date. And that brings me to the second reason that we think that we've had so few executions here, is that the lawyers that work in the state post-conviction office and in the federal public defender's offices around the state are simply some of the finest capital attorneys in the country. And they have done outstanding work in advocating for their clients, and in the process revealing many of the flaws that exist in the administration of capital punishment that Americans first came to know about through the actions of former Governor Ryan in Illinois back in 2000.
The defense lawyers have accused the Memphis judge of bias for blocking DNA tests on the murder scene evidence, while the state told an appeals court that Sedley Ali is just trying to delay his execution. Can you talk about the judge and what's happening in the case?
Well, I don't know about the judge personally. It certainly appears that the judge was predisposed to deny releasing the evidence. And in fact, we can step back just a step further. Governor Bredesen, as you mentioned, issued a temporary reprieve back in mid-May when Sedley Ali was scheduled for execution. And he could have taken the step of actually mandating the release of that physical evidence for DNA testing. Other governors around the country, including George Bush when he was governor in Texas and Jeb Bush as governor in Florida, have actually taken the step of forcing the release of evidence for DNA testing in order to achieve clarity and certainty in terms of the reliability of the conviction. And we certainly hoped that our governor would step up and do at least as well as the Bush brothers have done in this context. But he failed to do that. So he sent it back to the courts, letting the courts make the determination as to whether or not they would release the evidence for testing. And this is the same judge that denied that request in 2004. So it certainly doesn't come as a surprise that he would again refuse to release the evidence for testing. And the attorneys are currently going to the state Supreme Court here in Tennessee to appeal the denial of the Criminal Court of Appeals, which ruled yesterday and upheld the ruling of Judge Hicks in Memphis on this matter. And if there's no relief to be found at the state Supreme Court level, then they will go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court on this matter. But Sedley Ali's attorneys also have another track which they are pursuing, which is a challenge to the lethal injection protocol here in Tennessee. And as you may well know, the Supreme Court ruled last week in the case called Hill v. McDonough that the defendants on death row do have the right to challenge lethal injection protocol in the federal courts, which is something that they previously could not do. And so that's another avenue that Sedley Ali is pursuing in order to stop his execution.
Finally, Randy Tatel, perhaps one of the most famous Tennesseans, the former presidential candidate Al Gore, former senator of your state, was for the death penalty. Is that right?
Yes, certainly. Al Gore has, as most Southern politicians feel they need to do, has expressed support for the death penalty. I will point out that his daughter is a strong opponent of the death penalty and tried to give her father good counsel on that issue. But it's not surprising that a Southern politician, even at the national level, expresses support for the death penalty. And that's part of the culture that politicians still feel they have to be strong on crime, and part of the way that they demonstrate that is to express support for the death penalty. But I think more and more we're seeing that elected officials can step up to the plate and say that they are very strong on fairness in the administration of the criminal justice system, and in particular when you are talking about the potential taking of a human life. And so we believe that the environment and the ground is really changing for politicians. And as organizers, it's our responsibility to demonstrate to politicians who are, as we all know, risk-averse, that it's safe for them to begin to step away from their overt support for the death penalty.
Randy Tatel, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the Tennessee Coalition Against State Killing. Thanks so much for joining us from Nashville. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we turn to another death row case, that of Mumia Abu-Jamal, sentenced to death in 1982 for the killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Mumia Abu-Jamal was gravely wounded in the incident. A journalist, Black Panther, an outspoken critic of police brutality, racism, and the death penalty, Mumia Abu-Jamal has always maintained his innocence. Julia Wright is here with us now. She's the daughter of the late famed writer Richard Wright. She's visiting New York from her home in Paris, where she's involved in international concern family and friends for Mumia Abu-Jamal. We wanted first to go to a commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal, an audio tribute to Julia that Mumia recorded last week.
Julia, the eldest daughter of the great black literary lion, Richard Wright, has been a strong presence in people's movements on three continents for generations. She helped open up the famed international section of the Black Panther Party in Algiers, Algeria. When the Cleaver family left Algiers some years later, they found refuge with Julia and her family in Paris, France. And Julia founded the French branch of our support movement in 1995. A steady presence, a sister with open arms and heart when her people are in need. Not just the proud daughter of a pioneering writer and activist, but an activist and writer in her own right. Julia knows something about repression. You could say it's in her bones. Like millions of black Americans, her father was the fruit of Africans and native peoples. Her mother, Ellen Poplar Wright, was a Jewish survivor of the global genocidal Hitler regime. Thus, in that one woman, we see the crystallization of three inhuman genocidal assaults, the centuries-long war against Africans, the winnowing threshings of native indigenous peoples from almost all of what we call the United States, and the anti-Jewish pogroms in Germany and Nazi-occupied Europe. There's a reason she's so tough. She comes from tough, resilient people. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's tribute to you, Julia Wright. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And tonight in New York City, there's going to be a major event at Salem United Methodist Church, which is honoring you.
Yes, a tribute to me, but I'm going to use my talking time to make tributes to other people who are fighting at my side. It's a long haul, Amy. It's almost a generation of fighting. They want to see us breathless. We will not be. They want to see us tired. We refuse to be. They want to see what our strength is. We will not show it in advance. We will continuously surprise them. I'll give you an example. In Philadelphia, we say brick by brick, wall by wall, we're going to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Well, they did not understand what we were saying. They're stupid because what we meant was we are going to build streets. And the first street has been built. It's a new street on the outskirts of Paris, in the city of Saint-Denis, where the kings and queens of France are buried, a couple of them headless. This throws us back to the death penalty way back during the revolution. Anyway, there is a street that was named on the 29th of April, 2006, in honor of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
How did that happen in Saint-Denis, France?
It's because Mumia is a household name and a school hold name because he's in textbooks in France. He's the symbol of resistance. You know, résistance is a very important word in France. It hails back to the Second World War. It hails back to the resistance against Franco. And it's not a coincidence that this street is in Little Spain, where the resistance against Franco came to settle in exile. It's a wonderful event. I was there. two mayors were there, the former mayor and the present mayor. The former mayor is an elected representative to the National Assembly of France. Now, when the news broke on the 23rd of May that the FOP had gone hysterical,
the Fraternal Order of Police,
yes, in Philly, over the naming of this street, and had passed a concurrent resolution, 407, at Congress, demanding that the City Hall of Saint-Denis unname the street, and if they did not do this quickly enough, demanding that the sovereign national government of France unname the street in their place, the journalist in me woke up. I used to be a journalist. And I rushed to Saint-Denis late at night and stationed in front of the mayor's house and waited for him to come home from work. He came home and very surprised to see me. You know, what are you doing here? How's Mumia? Very serious news to break to you, Mr. Mayor. Oh, come into my house. He uncorked a bottle of very good French wine, and I'm smiling because they're asking for a boycott of French products because of this street now. Well, we drank to Mumia's liberation, and he said, "Je suis Breton. I hail from Brittany. I will not back down." Hmm. And
let me read to you from the Philadelphia Inquirer this week. As Philadelphians cope with another police slaying, news comes that a suburb of Paris has named a street for Mumia Abu-Jamal, convicted of the 1981 murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner. Hundreds of supporters of Abu-Jamal attended a ceremony April 29th to dedicate the Rue Mumia Abu-Jamal in the city of Saint-Denis. It says Suzanne Ross, co-chair of the Free Mumia Coalition, says in France they see him as a towering figure. Ross said the street is in the town's human rights district, which includes Nelson Mandela Stadium. Richard Costello, past president of the Philadelphia Lodge of the Fraternal Order of Police, said the street dedication was deplorable, but consistent with the offensive position the French have taken in this matter. They've made him into some type of hero. And it goes on to say that Maureen Faulkner, the wife of the slain police officer, urged Americans to boycott Paris. She said the people of Philadelphia should think, if they have any trips to Paris this summer, to cancel those trips. Your response?
My response to Maureen Faulkner is, we've reached out to her for years because we have a message for her. We feel for her. She has lost her husband. We are not inhuman. But we would like to say to her, the killer of your husband is still on the loose. And we have information to prove it.
Can you talk about the latest in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case? Several years ago, he was supposed to be taken off death row until an appeal of his case.
Right.
What is the legal status of Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, who's been on death row for well over two decades now?
Well, yes, almost a generation taken away from his life. Okay, a legal update. Three claims were granted for examination, legal examination. Two focus on racism in his case, rampant. One in jury selection, and we have a tape training prosecutors to be to select members of the jury on racist bias basis without seeming to be racist. This tape is signed producer Ron Castile, and Ron Castile is member of the Pennsylvania Philadelphia Supreme Court. So we have proof that there is racism in jury selection. We also have proof, but
I
think...
By the way, I just wanted to say that we did an hour with Harold Wilson, a man who was freed from death row in Pennsylvania, who was with Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row, and we played an excerpt of that videotape, of that training on how to select a jury and how to select out particularly African Americans, as well as others. And people can go to our website at democracynow.org to see it.
There's profiling, like a black woman, like me, don't select her. Okay, so there's also the hanging judge, Judge Szabo, very racist. I think, I'm not sure about the percentage of sentencing to death, but
this was the original court judge who has since retired.
Who has since died. We can no longer bring him to the stand. He is deceased. I'm sorry about that, but it remains that he was racist. He was racist during the original trial, and he was racist during the appeals proceedings. He refused to recuse himself. And Terry Mora Carter, stenographer in court, way back during the original trial, I believe, I may be making a mistake, but anyway, she was rushing through the court's chambers and she heard Judge Szabo say, "I will help them fry the nigger." And she's ready to go to the stand and be witness to that. There are so many other witnesses who want to speak, who need to speak, who have this on their conscience that they lied because they were pressured. And they will not be allowed to go to the stand because of the Effective Death Penalty Act and the fact that innocence is time barred in this country.
We're talking to Julia Wright, who is one of the leaders of the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal movement. Tonight we'll be at the Salem United Methodist Church in New York City. July 1st is another major event for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a protest and rally in Philadelphia, as happens every year about that time. You're also here in this country preparing for the centennial of your father's birth. Richard Wright, author of Native Son, Black Boy. How does that legacy relate to the work you do today? You, of course, also a writer yourself.
Yes. My father's legacy is so rich. He did so much. He went to Bandung. He went to Africa. He wrote Black Boy. He went into exile. He met Sartre. Simone de Beauvoir was a friend of the family. I mean, the richness of what he's left us. So I had to choose. And I chose his action on behalf of a lifer in the state of New Jersey. And he went to see the governor of New Jersey and said, "I'm Richard Wright. Here's what I've written. Would you let Clinton Brewer out under my wing?"
Explain who Clinton Brewer is.
Clinton Brewer was a lifer who killed the mother of two children. And the governor of New Jersey said, "Oh, Richard Wright, I've read all your books. Of course I'll let him out." This sounds like a fairy tale. This is back in 1941. I was in my mother's womb at the time. So, my father brought Clinton Brewer back home, gave him a room in our house, and found him work with Count Basie. He killed again. My father was obsessive about these things. He said he would find a psychiatrist to prove that Clinton Brewer, a black man, a poor man, practically illiterate, could not stand the pressure of racism. And he would have been sentenced to death had it not been for the intervention of the psychiatrist my father found. So I thought this was magnificent. I don't know why, it's mysterious why I chose this, but when I found out that Mumia was a writer and a powerful one, and a writer who has received prizes here twice in the United States and once in France. He's received a prize in France for one of his books. His latest book on the Panthers has received a prize here, I hear. But whether he's received prizes or not, his writing is so powerful. When I think he's doing it on death row with guards looking over his shoulder, and he's writing against the imperial wars of America, and he's got guards looking over his shoulder, I think this is a magnificent example of resistance, and France thinks this too. France abolished the death penalty in 81.
Why did your father move to France from the United States?
That's a beautiful question, Amy. Okay, I'll give you the answer. I was a little girl of 3 years old, and Connie Perlstein, a white woman, took me to Bergdorf Goodman. Whatever.
No relation.
I'm blocking on the name. And I needed to go to the toilet inside that department store, and the lady behind the counter said, "The toilet is over there." But as Connie went away, she saw this little black child trailing after her.
Which was you?
Which was me, a little. I don't remember that. But it's recounted countless times. And the sales lady said, oh no, you can't take her in there. And so I had to pee on the sidewalk. And I was given an ice cream cone to repair whatever dignity I had lost as a little girl, having to wet the sidewalk like a dog. But my father was in a rage, and that rage took him to Paris with me and my mother.
Your mother was a Holocaust survivor?
Yes. Yeah, I have 3 survivals in my blood. The Indians, the blacks, the Middle Passage, and the Holocaust. So I feel strong, I feel rich of that legacy. But can I go back to the FOP? Because the FOP has reacted to the street. And
The naming in
Saint-Denis on 29th of April. They've passed a concurrent resolution 407 in Congress. 3 demands. 1, Saint-Denis, unname the street, but quick. 2, Saint-Denis, if you don't unname the street quickly, we will ask the sovereign national government of France to do it in your place. And 3, very shocking, we command police officers throughout the world. Not only in America, but throughout the world. Now that sends a signal to right-wing police throughout the world that supporters of political prisoners in the United States can be targets, can be harassed, can be made breathless, can be made to kneel down. But we will not give up, and I think there is a laughable quality to that resolution. I mean, we burst out laughing in Saint-Denis. I interviewed the other mayor, myself.
We have 10 seconds.
Right, and he is an elected representative to the National Assembly of France. And we are being accused in Philadelphia of inventing this interview.
Julia Wright, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Julia Wright, daughter of literary giant Richard Wright, speaking out for Mumia Abu-Jamal, will be in New York tonight at the Salem United Methodist Church. That does it for today's broadcast. I'll be at Lerner Hall at Columbia University with Italian journalist Giuliana Scarena for a public interview. DemocracyNow.org is our website. You can go there for news. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.